F the Big Five.
F the Big Five. You've wanted to talk about this for quite some time.
I've started the video at least twice and gave up on it.
Cool.
Because I got bored. So it's about time.
Yeah.
So first, let's define some terms. What are we talking about?
What are the Big Five?
Well, the Big Five come out of the Big Three, which are squat, bench, deadlift, generally speaking. Sure, someone might replace the deadlift with one of the other two. Those are the Big Three movements.
Yeah, they're the powerlift.
Right. The Big Five.
The powerlifting meet.
The Big Five would include the overhead press and the bent over row. Those are usually considered the Big Five barbell movements that you will see in most 5x5 systems, starting strength, strong lifts, any number of them. You can go Google right now. Best exercises for mass gains. And more articles than not will have those listed. The big barbell movements are best for mass gains. You'll see it repeatedly.
You'll often see dips and chin-ups or pull-ups thrown in.
Yeah, I mean, there is slight variation. Years ago, Pavel wrote an article, I think it was overhead press or book Overhead Press and Deadlift with the big two, but it tends to revolve. Yes, there others will be included, but almost without exception, those will be part of it. Or the more general, if you don't do these lefts, you're a pansy. That's not the actual P word that's typically used, but I'll try to make this easier for you to not get demonetized or have to bleep out less of my language. Right.
Thank you. Very considerate.
I try. I know I've missed a couple times, but I'm doing my best. So these movements have been around forever. They are held up as the be all end all. You must squat, you must bench, you must deadlift. Now, yes, that's true if you're a power lifter. They are part of your competition package. Except unless you do push pull, because you don't want to squat, or bench only, because you don't want to squat or deadlift, or deadlift only, because you don't want to squat or bench. There's a Fed here that does squat only, and I can't imagine why anyone would want to do that. That's nuts. But they are part of the competition package. If you're a power lifter, you must do those movements. Olympic lifters generally must at least front squat. Whether or not they deadlift, that's a lot more variable. Most, I would dare say, do not. Not part of most systems. Very few bench press. Even strongman, you would be surprised at what patterns. I met a strongman competitor powerlifting meet a bunch of years ago. And he's like, yeah, I had to learn how to squat for this. He decided to come to a powerlifting meet. He's like, we don't squat for strongman because it's not generally a movement pattern that they do. Now they'll do deadlift. They'll do push press or strict press, like the log. They don't do bench, other than as general preparatory. They deadlift, because they usually do deadlift for reps of some sort. But yeah, he's like, yeah, I had to learn how to squat, or relearn how to squat, which I thought was interesting. But let's talk about performance. What about hypertrophy? Are these the best movements for hypertrophy? Now, let me qualify this, because everybody always mishears me, whether usually deliberately. Because they're incapable of listening to my word. Okay. I am not anti-squat. I am not anti-bench. I am not anti-deadlift. I did them all when I was younger. I was pretty good. I was decent at squat and deadlift. I was terrible at bench. I've trained powerlifters to high levels. I'm not against these movements in as much any more than I'm against most things. Matter of context, matter of situation. Any more than I am for or against training to failure. It depends. I realize this is a hard concept to understand. Because as soon as people hear this, they go, hey, Elijah just sucks at squats. No, I'm pretty sure I probably squatted more than you and better than you. I squatted high bar, rock bottom. I've competed in powerlifting at a mediocre level. I've trained powerlifters. Trust me.
I know more about squats than everybody.
Trust me. I've done more squats than you have. I missed.
Oh, that's great. You're being facetious, right? That's an appeal to authority.
I'm just making a point. People go like, oh, Lyle just doesn't like squats because he's bad. No, I used to love squatting.
Yeah.
I missed it for years. Now I can't do it because my hips messed up. And I don't bend that way anymore. I'm not against squats. I'm not, or bench or deadlift. I'm against the global recommendation of those movements for optimal hypertrophy. Let me rephrase that. I am against the global elevation of the big five as the best movements for skeletal muscle hypertrophy for all individuals. Do I have enough qualifications? Because now we're going to walk through them. Let's do that. Let's build a model of what stimulates hypertrophy. And I'll try to keep this quick. I think we talked about this in the previous thing, but for background. And look, if these other people can use appeals to authority, so can I.
The appeal to the bandwagon.
Yeah, whatever. Appeal to whoever I want to appeal to. Okay. Unless you're one of a couple of individuals in this industry, we know that to cause a muscle fiber to grow, it must be recruited. There are a couple of people that don't think that's true. I'm not getting into that discussion. I think they're wrong. Yes, fine, whatever, because they'll see. Yes, I get it. There is lateral tension through the integrins and the connective tissue matrix. Guys, I know more about it than you do. Trust me. Anyway. We're going to go from that context. Now, we know that muscle fibers can be recruited in one of two ways. Well, they generate force in one of two ways, recruitment and rate coding. Rate coding just means how fast the signals come from the brain. Recruitment means the fiber is actually being recruited. Now, muscle fibers are recruited in order from smallest to largest, from slow to fast twitch, according to something called Henneman's size principle. Basically, the more force you need to generate, the more high threshold fast twitch muscle fibers are recruited. Right, so if you're walking, slow twitch fibers, low force requirements. Move into a jog, maybe some type 2. Run to full sprint, high threshold. Now in the weight room, you can recruit, and you can recruit fibers through two different approaches. One, you can use very heavy weights. Above roughly 80 to 85% of maximum, about 5 to 8 reps, you'll get full fiber recruitment from about repetition 1, maybe repetition 2. So you can use heavy weights for low repetitions. Or you can use high repetitions to failure. That's why, hence the new idea. There is no hypertrophy range. Any repetition range will work if you go to failure. And there is contextual truth to that. So if you do a set of 8, you will probably get full recruitment from about rep 2. Let's say you do an all-out set of 8, just for example. Not recommending failure, making a point. You'll get 5 repetitions under full recruitment, what we're now calling effective repetitions. But let's say you do a set of 15 to failure. You won't get full recruitment until that rep 10. You'll get about, as you get tired, as bar speed slows, the body will have to call in higher threshold muscle fibers, type 2. The last 3 to 5 repetitions of an all-out set of 15 is neurologically, physiologically identical to the final 5 sets of a set of 8. You do a set of 25 to failure, same thing. The final 5 repetitions will look the same. They'll, physiologically, they're essentially the same. I don't want to get into the weeds on that. That's why it all generates the same hypertrophy. Because you're seeing full recruitment. You're getting the same 5 effect. The difference is just in how many reps you had to do to get there. Heavy set of 8? Well, let's say you do a heavy set of 5. 100 kilos by 5x5. You'll get full recruitment from rep 1. You got 5 effective reps. 5 reps under full recruitment.
Sure.
Did
assuming 75 you kilos
by 15? Well, even if you did a set of 5 at an 8 RM, you'll still get a number of repetitions at full recruitment. That's why you do not have to go to failure with heavy weights, but you do have to go to failure with light weights. And the data all shows
to
that.
It anyway, right?
No, with low load training, if it's not the failure, you don't get much growth.
How low are we talking?
They usually use 30% for 25 reps. Which
so that's very light.
Yeah, the low load stuff. Now, BFR is different. With blood flow restriction, you do get recruitment. You don't have to go to failure because the accumulation of metabolites increases fiber recruitment sooner. But it doesn't matter. Here's the point. to stimulate a muscle to grow, you must recruit it and you must expose it to some amount of mechanical work. My point is that you can get your recruitment in multiple ways. Heavy weights for low repetitions, lightweights essentially to failure for higher. Just a matter of how many you had to do beforehand, right? Even if people are like, oh, well, 25 reps gives you the same growth as eight. I'm like, yay, but you had to dick around for 20 to get there, right? It's the same, but you have to do three times as much work. It hurts 10 times as much, and you'll probably throw up. Doesn't improve bone mineral density. It doesn't improve maximal strength. So, yes, it's interesting in a physiological sense, but in a practical sense, I still think there is a practical hypertrophy range somewhere between 6 and 12. Low reps tend to take too long and wear out your joints. High reps are boring and make people want to throw up. And BFR mainly looks cool and edgy on Instagram. And I think that fad has gone. It's great if you're injured to reduce joint loading, but that's separate. Okay, let's continue building this model. We know that you do need to take a muscle to within a certain proximity to failure to get growth. Generally, I think most would agree, somewhere between 0 to 3. Zero reps in reserve, which would be you could not complete another repetition. 3 reps in reserve, you could get 3 more. That's usually, bar speed will generally have slowed at that point, which is generally a good indication that you have gotten full recruitment. You are nearing limits. Yes, I know there was one really dumb meta-analysis that looked at this that anybody that took seriously, I question. It suggested that you could get growth at 21 reps in reserve. So if you did 4 reps with a 25 RM load, you'd grow. Sure, cool, I believe you. Absolutely.
Amazing.
Amazing stuff. Maybe if you're untrained at 80. But even then, it showed that as you got closer to 0 reps in reserve, you did get more growth. 0 to 3, maybe 0 to 4.
That's all right. So where is this going? How does all this relate to the Big 5? I think I can see.
Sure, you can, but I'm getting there. Okay, so.
You'll get there.
We must recruit a fiber in the target muscle. We must expose it to a certain number of effective repetitions. And we can argue about how many might be optimal in a given workout. That's a separate discussion. And we know that we must take the muscle, to a certain proximity to failure, which we're going to say is between 0 and 3 reps in reserve. Because that's where people get it wrong. Generally in these studies, or in the real world, they talk about taking an exercise to a certain repetition and reserve. And this is a problem. So let's say our goal is to train the quads. People go, squats are best for quads. Well, squats is a complicated movement. It requires a good deal of coordination. It involves a lot of muscle groups. Quads, glutes, a little bit of hamstring, low back, upper back. There's a lot going on. Now, let's say I take a random individual to 2 reps in reserve on the squat, which I dare say most people listening to this have never done. And if you have, send me the video. I love to be proven wrong, and yet somehow people never send me the video. Because if it didn't slow down a lot, you didn't get, and I dare say none of you have ever gone to 0. I've done it. I've seen it done. I wouldn't recommend it. Let's say you take an individual to provably 2 reps in reserve. Okay. What caused that individual to stop the set? Was it their quads? Was it their glutes? Was it their low back giving out? Was it their upper back giving out? We don't know. Now, if someone is built well for squats, by which I mean they're typically, if they're not shorter, they have short femurs. They can squat very upright, very high bar, a lot of knee flexion. Not a lot of load on their low back or upper back. It's more likely that their quads are what limited the set. Now, let's take someone who's very tall, who has very long femurs, who has a weak upper back, who has a weak lower back. When they get 2 reps in reserve, can we say that their quads are what hit 2 reps in reserve? But we don't know. I don't know, and you don't know, and they might not have. Realistically, they probably didn't. Now, let's say I put that same person on a hack squat who has got long legs, and I take them in 2 reps in reserve. I can say with pretty decent certainty that their quads are probably what limited them. Yeah, it could be glutes. It could be other variables. But now let's say I put them on a leg extension machine and I take them to 2 reps in reserve. I know what failed. I know what muscle received an effective stimulus. It was the quads. It had to be. Because there's nothing else. There's nothing else it could be. Think about the bench press. Right? Again, we've got the balance, compound movement, the complexity, triceps, front delt, serratus anterior. If someone is built to bench, usually they typically have a barrel chest, very short arms. But take someone who's got big long ass arms like mine. I've got a long way to move a bench press. And likely my triceps are going to give out long before my chest. If I take a bench press to 2 reps in reserve, was it my pecs that got to 2 reps in reserve or was it my triceps? If I do a pec deck to 2 reps in reserve, I guarantee it was my pecs. So the reason that I say F the big five as a global recommendation is, well, let me back up. If we're talking about exercises for skeletal muscle hypertrophy, not strength, not getting better at the squat, hypertrophy. Hypertrophy is local. It means exposing the target muscle to a given tension and amount of mechanical work to a certain proximity to failure. Any exercise that has a limiting factor that is not the target muscle will not be an effective exercise for hypertrophy for that muscle. So if you are benching for chest and either don't know how to use your pecs during the bench, which is common, or your triceps are failing very early, that means that the pecs are not being exposed to a proper stimulus. Let's look at the deadlift. Okay. Solomon, what does the deadlift train?
Hamstrings, glutes, spinal erectors, traps, grip, if you're not using straps or if you have a really weak grip.
Right. People will say, I mean, the deadlift trains everything. There is no everything muscle. Right?
Yeah.
Growth is local. In training everything, the deadlift essentially trains nothing except the deadlift. Because if you are deadlifting, realistically, what is going to be limiting? Well, grip.
Probably the low back.
Straps. Generally, low back is what we'll give out. Generally speaking, unless you are built perfectly, everything is balanced. Well, if you're trying to train your low back, maybe that's fine, but there are way more time efficient and energy efficient ways of training your low back that will not exhaust you.
You could do like Jefferson curls.
Whatever. Do back extensions. I don't give a shit. Like it doesn't, sorry, I don't give a damn. Like whatever. to use deadlifts. I once had someone tell me, I think of squats as a core exercise. If you're using squats to train core, you are doing it wrong. Why would you use an exercise so physically exhausting to train your core for God's sake? Deadlifts are physically and emotionally exhausting. If you got to get a better deadlift, you got to do it. Make no mistake. But what are they training in terms? What target muscle is being exposed to the proper stimulus? Nothing. Bent over row, it's usually the low back that gives out. Long before upper back. Now, am I saying that these movements are inherently bad? No, and that's where people get confused. I noticed years ago that this is how most people will approach exercise selection and recommendations. If someone says, this exercise is best for hypertrophy, it means they're built for it. Period. It fits them. They are able to use it to effectively train the target muscle to a sufficient proximity to failure. If they say this exercise is bad for hypertrophy, either they're not built for it, or they never learned how to do it properly, but it's usually the first one. And here's a really interesting example of this. Someone I know knows Tom Platz personally. Tom Platz was built to squat, and he learned high bar Olympic squatting from a very early age.
I think I know who this someone is. Up about Tom Platz.
I'm not sure I remember.
All the experiences he's had with him.
But
anyway,
Tom Platz would say, oh, you got to squat for big legs.
Yeah.
Because he was built for it. But in the same breath, he would go, Because there was another bodybuilder that said, oh, yeah, bench press is best for pecs. And Tom Platz would go, no, I don't think bench is very good for chest. Because he wasn't built for it. But he couldn't see that the reason he felt that squats were best for quads, they might have been best for him. And that's fine. So what happens is you get people that happen to be built for certain, well, for certain movements, or just have a macho attachment more than anything. They think, oh, well, this is best for me because I'm built for it. Works great for me.
Yeah.
And then you get somebody who's tall, who's built like you or Sunni, for whom squats are a low back movement, and they never get anything out of their quads ever.
I believe I have gotten a decent amount out of squats, but it's been, you know, a lot of effort, like getting the movement right for me. I train at home for the unaware listeners. I just have a barbell power rack and I make do, you know?
Right. And there are ways to make things better in terms of, you know, you can get heeled shoes. You can, you know, put your heels up to get you a little bit more upright.
I have a wedge, you know, and I can squat reasonably upright.
But the wedge but that makes a really big difference because it is changing the biomechanics. Someone that can't do that doesn't have that option. You know, and again, and some of this, like, you will, and this is where you'll see differences between women and men. Right? Now, there are no women specific and men specific exercises. That was the thing back in this. There were, you know, mass gaining exercises and toning exercises, and men did one and women did the other and all this other ridiculous shit. But there is some truth to that. Many women, well, the majority of women have more muscle mass in the lower body than their upper body. Men tend to be a little more even. So women's legs can frequently move a lot more in the squat than their shoulder can comfortably shoulder. So if they're back squatting from quads or glutes and their upper back is what's giving out, they have picked an exercise that has a limiting factor that is not the target muscle. That's why hip thrusts were a very valuable movement. It took the upper body out of it. It took all that other stuff and allowed the glutes to be isolated. So when I say F the Big Five, I'm not saying it in a global sense. I'm saying that those are the best movements for hypertrophy for all people is myopic. It's really a bunch of macho BS because weight training is the only place I can think of that in 2025, people are still married to 100-year-old technology. There is nowhere else in the world where people are like, well, this is how guys got big in the 20s. We should go back to slide rules, like calculators, cell phones. Let's go back to the telegraph. The reason guys did squat, bench, deadlift in the early 20th century is that's all there was to do. They did that because that's what was available. They didn't have squat. I read a great paper on the history of the back squat just recently. They didn't even have squat racks till like the 30s, right? They used to rock the bar up under there. That was all. And even then, they were trying to find more efficient ways to train the muscle. Early leg press variations. They just crazy stuff. And I think there's a reason that if you look at a lot of top bodybuilders, especially the ones that stay injury free, they do a lot more machines than free weights in the modern era because a well-built machine will let you isolate and focus the target muscle in a way that the big barbell movements frequently do not. If you're not built to deadlift, if you've got bad levers, you're not only going to get nothing out of that movement, you're going to get hurt.
Now, one counter argument might go, yes, your low back might be the first thing to fail on a properly executed deadlift. But if you take your deadlift from 200 pounds to 500 pounds, then no matter how poorly you're built for it, all the muscles involved in the deadlift will have hypertrophied in the process. That's yes, obviously low back, but also hamstrings, traps, glutes. You think that's a stretch?
No, I don't disagree with that, except for the fact that if someone's not built for a deadlift, it's never going to happen in a million years.
200 to 500?
Hell no. How many 500-pound deadlifts have you ever seen, dude?
I mean,
I've been in gyms for 30 years. That 300, 400, 500? Tell me how many you've ever seen anyone. Go into any commercial gym.
Yeah, I haven't really seen it.
It's not a common, you don't see that. So yes, that argument is there, but when you talk to people that are not built for these movements, they train them for years and make no results. They get no gains. So yeah, that's a great theory. That's like the argument of, well, What would be bigger shoulders, a 300-pound overhead press or a 30-pound lateral raise? Well, A, that shows total ignorance of lever arms, but I've never seen a 300-pound overhead press. And someone not built to overhead press is never going to get from 95 pounds to 300 ever.
So you don't disagree in, you know, theory, but just in practice, it probably won't happen.
No, it's not a matter of probably won't. It's a matter of it never, like, it just doesn't.
Yeah, like, just, if you're really cool,
it just doesn't happen. Especially not for reps. Maybe you could pull 500 by 8 in a, hell no. Absolutely not. I mean, look, here's an appeal to authority, but it just happens to make my point.
Yeah.
The Chinese Olympic lifters who have made being jacked a national pastime, right? Olympic lifters have gone through phases of being relatively more or less muscular. Those guys put bodybuilders to shame. And here's how they train. They actually train the way I've trained people my entire career. He said, not at all, smugly. They practice the Olympic lifts relentlessly. Heavy reps, low rep. Heavy weights, low reps. They fix weak points, very specific exercises. They squat twice a week. And then they do bodybuilding work, usually isolation stuff. Because all the coaches care about is stimulating the muscle for hypertrophy. Because a larger muscle is a potentially stronger muscle. They do just bodybuilding stuff. Various lateral raises, leg extensions. I mean, I'm sure some of them, but a lot of them, they tend to be very short. They don't squat for, they squat for performance. They don't squat for size. Right? Dorian used mostly machines by the end of his career. One of his big learnings, he said, you know, he was back squatting and got hurt. And he switched to the Smith machine. And he realized, wow, this is actually a much better quad stimulus on top of being safer. Because when you get that strong, trying to squat for high reps is a good way to get wrecked if something goes wrong. I think there's a reason that he stayed relatively injury-free his entire career. Eventually, the heavy barbell stuff catches up with you. And there are often, again, I'm not saying they're bad for everybody. There are cases where they must be used, like if that's all the equipment you've got and you have to work within the potential that you've got. But if you're not built for that movement, if that exercise has any limiting factor that is not the target muscle, that's really the most generalized statement I can make. And I know we did talk about this at one point. Forget if it was like, you know, what are like the four big components of making that make an effective hypertrophy exercise, which is that it must fit the person, allow them to train the target muscle to a sufficient intensity, be safe and progressible. And for people with poor biomechanics, poor is the wrong word, the people with certain biomechanics, the big five are a losing battle. Period. And there will be other, and I maintain, one of these days I'll get a guinea pig. And I've said this, and nobody has yet to give me a reason why this wouldn't work. I maintain that you could take someone from untrained to their genetic potential with nothing but isolation exercises. Because there will be, that will allow you to train the target muscle as effectively, as directly, as efficiently as humanly possible. And I've had people go, that won't work. And I say, why? And they go, because you're stupid, LOL. No one, I've yet to hear a physiological, now yes, there are practical issues. I'm not talking about practicalities, right? Obviously, compound movements can be efficient. They train multiple muscles. I'm not saying that. You can run into problems with incrementing isolation movements. There are practical issues that would cause problems with this. You're trying to train upper body and you're doing 8 sets of isolation movements with no crossover. That's a lot of volume, right?
Like, yeah.
That's a separate issue, though. From a purely physiological standpoint, in terms of stimulating the target muscle or muscle group, and that's a separate complexity. That just has to do with exercise choice. I see no fundamental reason why. And if you don't agree with that, well, then answer me the question. Why can you get big biceps with nothing but isolation barbell curls? Why wouldn't that work for quads? Why wouldn't that work for hamstrings? Why wouldn't that work for pecs? If it'll work for biceps and triceps or delts, why wouldn't it work for the bigger? Because you got to squat or you're a pansy.
Because of Israetel's mythical raw stimulus story. Magnitude
cool
concept.
Cool story, bro.
What? You remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
Like, well, oh, again, these movements are inherently more hypertrophic.
Logic and actual science. If you can get the biggest biceps possible with nothing but an isolation exercise, why fundamentally would it not work? We know that in a lean back, here's one that'll piss everybody off. If I was going to pick one quad exercise for someone, like, I don't like the, you could only do one exercise per muscle group question because I think it's dumb. But sometimes there's a
you
situation
pick leg
that's
extensions.
Like, yes, and here's why. We know that compared to a leg press or a squat or a hack squat, leg extensions hit the rectus femoris and the others don't. If you wanted to hit all four heads of the quadriceps, VMO, VL, RF, and vastus intermedius that no one cares about because it's deep, a leg extension would get it and a leg press or squat or hack squat wouldn't. If you had to pick one exercise, it would be leg extension. If you had to pick one for hamstrings, oh, well, RDLs, aha!
Yeah, they don't hit the biceps femoris shorthead.
What about biceps femoris shorthead, which is only a deflexor?
They just hit the semitendinosus, semimembranosus, and biceps femoris longhead. Yeah.
Only leg curl will hit all four in one exercise. Haha.
Yeah.
Au contraire, mon frère. So there you go.
Still, you could build some pretty massive hamstrings with RDLs and squats. Massive quads and hamstrings with squats and RDLs alone. You could. It's been done many times.
And many people have toiled at squat for years and gotten nothing. Like, this was probably propaganda.
Sure.
Like, Fred Hatfield, Arthur Jones claimed that Fred Hatfield had the weakest quads of anyone he'd ever tested, which is probably propaganda BS. But if you the thing is, but if you look at the way Hatfield squats, it was all low back, glutes, and hamstrings. He was not a quad. Powerlifting squats done frequently are not quad dominant. Even Luby said that. He focused on the posterior chain for squats because the way they squatted was way more hip dominant. You can find plenty of powerlifters that do not have great quads until they start doing bodybuilding stuff. And then their quads explode because they're actually training the quads for the first time.
Yeah, the way I squat is narrow stance, plenty of heel elevation, high bar, pause at the bottom, control on the way
down. Absolutely. Yes, but the thing is, but without specific equipment or specific, for many people, that can't be done. And once femurs are beyond a certain point, there ain't nothing you can do to get people upright beyond a certain point. We spent years with Sumi.
Not even in stiletto heels.
Well, maybe. We had her in a 1.25-inch heel. We worked. She toiled. She had great ankle mobility. Is only ever going to be so good. It was a terrible quad. And I built what little quad she had with isolation, leg extensions, and hack squats. Because squats were going to be a losing battle for her. There was always going to be a set limiter that was nothing to do with her quads.
Mm.
So again, to sum up, I am not against the big five barbell movements. I am against the global recommendation of them being best for hypertrophy for all people. And I still would argue that for a majority of people, if your goal is hypertrophy, F the big five up, period, unless that's all you've got. You've got access to well-built machines that let you train the target muscle more effectively, more efficiently, with less overall stress and exhaustion. You'll get more gains.
Right. So I guess a follow-up question could be, what would be your go-to replacements for each of the big five? If squats are held to be a great lower body movement, what might you replace it with?
Hack squat, pendulum squat.
Yeah. Just for the stability factor.
Anything to simply remove the stability component, the low back issue, the upper back issue. And the fact that if something goes wrong on a back squat, you get wrecked, right? You tip over, you get out of position, something happens. Back squat, you get wrecked. That does not happen on those other exercises. Bench press, I would put in any chest press.
Yeah, and people really shouldn't take that lightly. Like, yeah, it's dangerous, and people forget that. Squatting with a barbell on your back. Like,
yes, if something goes wrong, you
died doing it multiple times.
Yes, people get severely injured. And trust me, if you ever had a low back injury, you never want one again. Because their life, like, they can be career enders, right? And as you get stronger, progressive tension, like, again, there's a limit. There's a limit. Squatting heavy weights for reps is a...
I'm not trying to fearmonger. Perfect. I'm sure you're not either.
No, but, I'm absolutely not. It's
I think it is important. Yeah, just to know, yeah, like, things can go seriously wrong whenever you're in the weight room. And some exercises lend themselves to injuries more than others.
Well,
factually.
Yes, not to mention that, and I'll come back to this. People will often, it's always interesting to me, the exercises that people will choose to promote and choose to deny based on injury risk. Let me come back to that in a second. Because frequently they'll be like, oh, this small isolation exercise, potentially injurious, but I recommend squats, power cleans, and deadlifts to everyone. Anything can cause an injury if something goes wrong, but the magnitude, scope, and type of injury can be very different.
Yes.
I've had a shoulder impingement, and they're no fun. I'll take that over the disc injury I had, the spinal injury I had, any day of the week.
Mm.
Injury is not one thing, and some injuries are career enders. Or if not, they'll make the rest of your life super miserable. And trying to go heavy on the big barbell movements constantly over time will take its toll. Sorry, can take its toll. Hell, even if you look at Platts, he was not doing high rep squatting every workout. He talked about that. He only
squatted came through once every 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's not how people are thinking, like, oh, you know, especially the squat high frequency BS. But it's like, yeah, but if you actually look at what he was doing, yeah, he was doing the big squat where we're not
should
doing
should tell you not, about Ivan Juric later. Yeah, anyway, later. Whatever.
So, for most people, hack squat, pendulum squat, quad dominant leg press, you'll be able to actually hit the target muscle with less overall fatigue and with less potential risk. Like, yeah, can you get hurt on a leg press? Yeah, if you round your low back and do something. Absolutely. I'm not saying that machines are injury risk free, but I've had stuff go wrong on a back squat. I've seen stuff go wrong on a back squat. When it goes wrong, it goes bad very quickly and very, very badly. Okay, bench press, any chest press. Machine chest press, good hammer chest press. Anything that takes away the stability and the fear.
Yeah.
Right? Now, the bench press is probably one of the few places where people have truly gone to zero reps reserve, although it's usually crappy high school bouncing bench press BS. But you're training by yourself. Talk about people dying. Bench press is a great way to do it. You get a bar dropped on you or you get it caught in your throat, you're done. I've seen some ugly things. Again, I'm not fear-mongering. I'm saying it happens a lot. But if you go to zero, let's say you're going to zero reps reserve. Again, not recommending failure. Let's say that that's how you train. You get a true failure on a bench press. You don't get that last rep and you don't have a spotter, you are in trouble. Or you get out of...
Yeah, I have safeties, so sure. I can go to zero RI or on bench. I do it often,
yes,
more than I should, I think. But
yeah, I've done it in a safety rack or always with safeties.
Yeah.
If you're on a chest press and you get stuck, you just go, doink, and you're done. Mm. Nothing bad happens. And you will be, and if you learn to bench with your pecs, an article on my website called Bench with the Pecs, because most people are very bad at it, you will actually get a better chest. You've taken away the balance component. Right now, triceps may still be limiting on a chest press. So maybe you pre-exhaust. Maybe you do a couple sets of pec deck first and then go to chest press. There's actually, I want to say it was Lee Labrada. I saw some dumb reel on Facebook. But there, I know there have been bodybuilders that even when they back squatted, they didn't last in their leg workout. And his logic...
Must have been
was,
Lee Priest.
Yes, I think you're right.
He, at the very least, just talked about this. I know where you go.
Because that way, he could back squat. He'd already done leg extensions, hacks, whatever. His quads were tired. It allowed him to use much lighter weight on that movement. And still, and I think he was also in the Smith machine, and actually get a better quad stimulus without all the other issues that are inherent to putting 4 or 5 wheels aside on a squat ball. So that would be, you know, and I actually with a lot of people that I can consult, also available consultations on my website. Mike has no tan coupon will apply. If you want me to
check
battle
the description.
For an hour or two.
Check the description, because I got some shackles that way.
For people that have certain biomechanics, I frequently will have them start with an isolation movement, right? Like for chest, I'll have them do a pec deck first for a couple sets to pre-fatigue the pecs. And then they'll do a chest press movement as a secondary chest movement. So now the triceps, rather than limiting their chest stimulus, allow them to get a better chest stimulus because now they're helping rather than holding back. So yeah, a chest press. Deadlifts, there is nothing really replaces the deadlift. Just don't do it. Just pick something better that actually trains a target muscle rather than everything. There is no everything muscle. Bent over rows, any chest supported row. Literally any chest supported row.
I guess I think I've asked this before, but you know, wouldn't the logical response to the claim that if a movement trains everything, it trains nothing be, well, no, doesn't that just mean it trains everything? If it trains everything, it trains everything.
But it can't. In involving so many muscles, there is no guarantee of which one or any multiple of those muscles will actually get a stimulus. That's my point.
Yeah. Good.
We are talking about, we have to take a target muscle to a given level of proximity to failure to get the recruitment, mechanical work, effective reps, blah, 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 blah. We don't know in an exercise involving that many muscle groups, when you hit two reps in reserve, we don't know what muscle was at two. We don't know what any of the other muscles were at. Maybe they were at a place that got a stimulus. Maybe they weren't. We don't know. Whereas in relatively more stable movements that are relatively more isolation, right? Compound isolation is a continuum.
Yeah.
And here's something that I find interesting among the physique intelligentsia. They will make this big deal about how all the unstable exercises, all the dumb BOSU ball stuff and functional nonsense and all that, just kind of gone away, but was a big thing in the 2000s. Oh, those exercises are bad for hypertrophy because the instability limits the stimulus to the target muscle. Okay. Why does that not hold to a degree for squats? But what they do is they go, okay, here's the continuum. Leg extensions, leg press, hack squat, pendulum squat, back squat, split squat or lunge, one-legged squat on the BOSU ball. Here's the continuum, right? And they go, well, this is dumb. They draw their line exactly on the side of what they like. They go, well, squats are stable-ish enough. And yes, they are more stable. I'm not saying they're not. But they're still less stable than a pendulum squat. They're less stable than a hack squat. Where is the line? The line is whatever makes them right. And I'm just saying that you need to consider the continuum. That in many cases, except in the standpoint of hypertrophy, probably the best argument I ever saw, this was on my website years ago. I wrote a piece called Leg Pressing for Big Legs. And I made basically this argument. For the majority of people, a leg press to the low back, upper back stability would be a better exercise for quad growth than the back squat. And some true rocket surgeon, brain scientist, put in the comments, it's clear Lionel McDonald knows nothing about training because the lack of stabilizer involvement in the leg press means there will be a lower growth hormone response. And folks, you cannot make that up because clearly involving the hip external rotators, the gluteus minimus, the obturator externus is crucial to the overall growth response of squats. Seriously, dumb as shoot. Okay.
I put that continuum argument to you last time we talked about exercise selection in our high-intensity training podcast, and you liked it.
Overhead press, FEO overhead press. Honestly, properly done lateral raise, properly done upright row, your medial delts will explode. I guarantee it because I've had people do this for a decade. You have finally abandoned the overhead press, done a lateral raise and or upright row or both in the way that I teach them, and their medial delts exploded.
Yeah.
The overhead press, if anything, is a front delt exercise because the medial delts are on the back of the shoulder when you do that movement anyway. It's got all this technical stuff, farting around the face, teratus anterior fails. Yeah, there's some guys that are always built really well for that movement. They get a lot out of the overhead press, but they're always built a certain way. Somebody with long arms who's having to just get, they're never going to get more than 40 kilos on the bar. They go to a lateral raise and take that exercise too. I know what got trained. They do a proper upright row. I know what got trained, which leads me to my got in an argument with someone years ago. They were like, this is back when upright rows were the horror exercise. No one should ever do upright rows.
Thank They're you, dangerous. Jeff Cavalier.
Yeah, this is long before him. This is back in NFW days.
He at least spread it to probably more than anyone else did.
I've been around since long before that. I used to think that too until I got better. And yes, because internally rotated, for God's sakes, this position can cause an impingement. No doubt. That's been around for decades. And if you do an upright row, right row that way, yes, you can get an impingement. And that's fine. And they were like, well, here's why the upright row is dangerous. I said, okay, hit me. They go, well, most people do it wrong. I go, that's non-discriminatory for the upright row. People do every exercise wrong. I've seen people screw up wrist curls, right? Saying people do it wrong is not an argument, right? And there were a couple others. I said, okay, so let me get this straight. You're telling me that you think the upright row is a problematic movement, but you recommend squat, bench, and deadlift to everyone because those movements are never done incorrectly in the weight room and have no risk. Are you kidding me? I had someone in my group do that recently. They tried to make the argument that because of that slight internal rotation, there was a slight risk of impingement. And then they were like, something came up and they were like, oh yeah, rugby's a great sport. I'm like, so let me get this straight. Lateral raise is dangerous. Rugby is fine. Cool. Cool story, bro. Let's just draw the dumbest line in the sand I've ever.
I guess just to steel man that argument, you could say there may be nothing inherently wrong with a properly executed squat, bench, or deadlift, whereas there is something inherently wrong mechanically with the up. Well, yeah, but that would be this because of the impingement risk because of the internal rotation.
But there's not if you do it properly. That's my point. Done properly, there is no impingement risk. There's also
do you want to like stand up and demonstrate a properly executed upright row?
Yeah, but I got to pee first. I also pointed out to this guy in the rehab world, you know, one of the exercises they use for rotator cuff rehab? It's called the empty can exercise. They literally do a lateral raise in internal rotation. Well, guess what? That's all an upright row is. So I just told the guy to get that. I go, you know what? Clearly done in a controlled, proper way. This is fine. It's a matter of when it's done incorrectly. All right. So, the upright row. Let's go ahead and get this out of the way.
Yeah.
So the way people used to do upright rows way back in the day. Don't know. All right. Take a bar, narrow grip, and then you do that.
Right.
Right. Elbows high, all the way up, bar to the chin. Now that is absolutely an impingement waiting to happen. You're internally rotated in horizontal abduction. I don't disagree. Well, that's not how I teach an upright row. There are a few components to this, and I do the same thing with lateral raises, which I'll demonstrate next. Number one, right, so you're not pulling this way. Number one, your upper arm, the humerus, your other funny bone, should stay in what's called the mid-scapular plane, right? It's not directly to the side, not here. This is the mid-scap plane.
Like a 30 degree angle.
30, somewhere in that range. Yeah. So the upper arms are moving to here.
Yeah. So your hands are slightly out in front of you. You're not dragging them out in front of your body. Yeah.
And
you're not dragging against your body.
Right. The reason for that is twofold. One is that it keeps the medial delt on top of the shoulder. But if you're doing here, the medial delt will go back. But also the rotator cuff is better able to stabilize the shoulder joint in the mid-scap plane.
Mm.
But importantly, you don't pull any higher than that. Part of the sternum. Once your upper arm is here, going higher is not more delt. It's just more impingement. So the way I teach an upright row is that.
Yeah, so where your humerus is basically parallel with the floor.
Yeah. And I teach lateral raise exactly the same, right? Most people do, people do lateral raises all kinds of terrible ways. But the typical way is what? It's the back. Medial delt is on the back of the shoulder right now. Whereas A, and also you lean forward slightly, the medial delta is directly on top of my shoulder. Mm. Line of pull is exactly with the weight. Same thing here. Lean forward at like 15 degrees. That's a lateral raise. Mid-scap plane, medial delt. Now, if you look at this part of my arm, right? Upright row, sorry, lateral raise, upright row. It's doing the same thing. It's just a matter of you're letting your biceps hold. That's it. Now, with the upright row, the only thing I'd add for anybody who wants to try it this way, the big issue is that with like a bar, the wrists get a little bit kinked. Right? You can see that they're a little bit twisted here.
Hmm.
A couple ways around that. One, you can use dumbbells, which let you, you know, spread your hands apart. I suppose you could use a wide, I don't know, I've never done it that way, but you could use like a wider grip. Usually what works best is to use a tricep rope on a low cable because it lets you let your hands come apart when you're doing that.
Nice.
The number of people I have known
it's
over...
like a quasi-lateral raise.
I mean...
Well, it's how to think of it in general.
It's just, like I said, well, I mean, look, most of these movements, I mentioned that in my group, and someone was like, you know, what does an upright row do that a lateral raise? Isn't it just a lateral raise with an arm bend? I go, well, isn't a bench press just a pec deck with an arm bend? Isn't a cable shrug back with an arm bend? I mean, it is. Like, okay, for anybody listening to this, let me go ahead and teach you how to bench with your pecs. I can do it in 10 seconds. Anybody watching this, I want you to go through this with me. All right, what do the pecs do? The pecs are here. Predominantly, they adduct the humerus.
Yeah, right?
They pull the upper arm across the body, right? Pec deck, cable crossover. Now, watch the upper part of my arm. Pec deck, bench press. It's doing the same thing.
Mm.
The difference being that my elbow is bending. So what happens to a lot of people because they bench, like I don't feel my chest, because they think of the bench press as a push. Push.
Hmm.
Triceps. For hypertrophy, think of the bench press or any chest press as a pull. You are using the pecs to pull the upper arm across the body. That makes sense? Pec deck, you're pulling the upper arm across the body. Chest press, you're pulling. Your arm will straighten. I promise you, if you're doing a barbell bench press or a dumbbell bench press or a machine chest press, if you think about pulling your upper arm across the body, your elbows will straighten and you will actually use your pecs. Solomon, I can teach it to you. Roll your camera down a little bit so people can see what you're doing. Okay.
Hang on, how about now?
Yep. Take one hand, put it on the opposite pec. Okay, raise your arm to the side. Now, do like a cable crossover pec deck movement. Right? And you should feel your pec kind of expand into your hand, right? You can feel it kind of pump up, right?
Yeah.
Do that a few times. Okay, now bend the elbow and bench press. And think about pulling. The pecs pull the upper arm across. That's how you bench with the pecs. And I think that's why a lot of people find that they're like, oh yeah, I don't feel flat bench in my chest, but I feel dumbbells better. Because dumbbells, the nature of it allows you to do what? To bring them in at the top. A lot of those stupid functional chest machines do the same thing. They started putting it on angled handles. So they started wide and they kind of forced you to think about pushing in instead of straight away. But I just teach it with technique. You do that on a chest press, you'll get way more out of your pecs than you ever do.
Yeah, cool.
So like I said, the number of people I know who toiled at the overhead press for nothing, as soon as they switched to, they're not even done properly. Some people's shoulders do not like lateral raises, and that's fine. They do not like upright rows for whatever reason. Some people just don't have the scapular control, the rotator cuff control, and that's fine. Properly done lateral raise, I guarantee you, with your slight forward lean, upper arm in the mid-scap plane. If you go look, I guarantee you, Jeff Nippert has a video where he demonstrates exactly what I just showed. The difference being that I've been teaching it that way for 20 years.
Cool.
So that's what I would pick instead of the big five. Any lower body movement that takes the low back, the upper back, and the knee. Like, look, even a Smith machine squat where you can set your biomechanics, right? Because if you have a long, if you have long femurs, the problem is that to maintain the bar over your center of gravity, you have to be very bent over. Now, you can do it because you've got, you know, a wedge and you can get yourself to a more upright position. Not everyone has that. On a Smith machine, because you don't have, you know, you can start here and kind of, you're almost leaning back into the bar. Put your feet on, your heels on plates or a board or whatever, and you can actually do, because you're not going to tip ass over tea kettle. Like you can't do that with a barbell, right? Like you can't stand in that position with a barbell because you tip over. Even a Smith machine back squat for people with bad levers, you'll get more out of your quad because you can set it up so that quads are going to be what limits you to two reps in reserve, or hack squat, or pendulum squat, or quad dominant leg press, which if it has a problem, it's that usually the range of motion is very limited. You don't get as much knee flexion, or leg extensions. And so that's lower body. The chest press we already talked about. Rows, any chest supported row, just to take the low back out of it, will be a better choice. Whether it's a hammer machine, a T-bar row. Cable rows are fine. They can be low back limiting. I would generally prefer a chest supported row if it's available, but cable row, but again, it's because you're not standing up and you've got, and like I said, we already talked about shoulders. So like anybody listening to this, just try it. Try it for the next 6 weeks. Report back. I love being told that I'm right. So there you go. That's the big five. Like I said, I generally, if I was going to train someone for bodybuilding explicitly and we had access to the equipment, I don't think at this point in my career, I wouldn't even teach them the big barbell movements. I'd just start them on machines.
Yeah.
And not even, I mean, why? What, I mean, that younger me probably wouldn't have taken that. Like at this point in my career, like, why? What?
I guess a lot of people actually just like them, keeps them coming back to the gym.
And that's right. And that's fine. And look, I'll pander as much as anyone else if I have to. And like, also, again, this goes to like the fact that I don't hate the squat. I don't. It's people aren't built for it. A lot of people I consult with, they're like, look, I still enjoy back squatting for whatever reason, or even deadlifting. And that's great. I tell them to keep it in as a movement rather than as a lift, if that makes any sense. So simply because if they don't have good levers for it, also trust me, folks, as you get older, and I am old, trust me, it will wear you out. As a official member of the old fart club in my gym, the grand majority of guys, they always want to talk about the good old days, which I don't care about. I don't care how much they benched in high school. I don't. I just want to train and leave. Every single one of them, almost without fail, they're like, yeah, when I quit trying to back squat heavy, that's when I got my life back because I don't hurt all the time. There is a with dotage comes not only decrepitude, but sometimes wisdom. Or at least you learn not to do, or at least you learn not to do so much stupid crap. But with people that I've consulted with that want to maintain those movements, but either they have hypertrophy or whatever as a goal, I'm like, look, fine, use that as a movement. Meaning do a couple warm-ups, do two sets of five to the first bar speed slowly. Maybe that's an 8 RM. Stop. That's it. I would also ask. Again, this is for folks as they get, you know, more decrepit like me. How big of a squat do you effing need? Right? If you're 40 and you're not a competitive power lifter and you think you need to have a 200 kilo squat, I would ask you for what? Assuming you can do it. How strong do you need to be as a non-competitive lifter in a movement that can absolutely wreck the rest of your life if something, because trust me.
I mean, even in a competitive lifter, you can ask the same question at your sort of age, why?
Well, I mean, fine. Look, some people are still highly competitive at that age, and that's fine. But if you're just like Gen Pop wreck lifter, how big of a squat do you need for your daily functional activities? Like, even before my hip crapped out and I was still squatting, I'm like, whatever. I was doing, I don't know, 185 for two sets of eight. Like, yeah. I can't meet again. I'm pretty broke between the leg I broke a bunch of years ago. My ankle doesn't move the way it used to, and now I've got arthritis in my hip. I don't bend that way anymore. I basically train to stay in mostly one piece. But even when I was, I'm like, how, there's that part of me, because I'm a dumb dude, is like, dude, you used to squat so much more than this. Just add 5 pounds. Just get back to 225. And I would add weight, and everything would hurt again. I'm like, yeah, don't.
By the way, when I asked why earlier, I didn't mean that condescendingly. I just meant it is a question we should all be asking.
But it is a question.
Why do we want to lift these really, really heavy weights?
Right, unless you are competing in something, like, you genuinely need to ask.
And even then, I think it's a good question to ask. What's the point?
Look, if you're a competitive powerlifter, sure, you got to keep doing it. And guess what? Most of those guys are busted when they get older. Trust me, especially squats more so than anything. I took Sumi to a master's meet early in her career. And man, the old man knees, it takes you an hour to just be able to hit that, to warm that stuff up when your knees start to. So a lot of those guys got to push pull. But yeah, it's just like, even like I said, competition is different. It's not meant to be healthy. But if you're like looking at longevity, trust me, eventually it will catch up with you unless you're just built perfectly for it and get really lucky. And which can probably lead into, we've got a question you want to address, but you're like, how to avoid injury in the weight room. But sort of to sum all this up, it's like, yeah, he really must squat. If you're just like, I don't feel right if I don't back. And again, I get it. I do. If I weren't injured, I would probably do back squats, but I was built for them. And I did. I was sick.
You enjoy them too.
I did enjoy them. I did, and trust me, I did. And look, I mean, I've done 20 rep squats. I've done sets of 50 in the back squat. Trust me, if it can be done, I've done it. But I was good, and I was built for it.
That's gross.
That was a gross workout. I wouldn't recommend that. But yeah, I've done it. So, but I would just do it as a lift. I would do it, work up a couple moderate sets, keep my brain happy, keep my macho, you know, and then I would go do the real work on machines, where I can actually just train the target muscle and not have to worry about any of the stuff that goes along with that.
Yeah.
Because again, it's like, so there's a, I mean, I've been saying this for years, and of course I was like, oh, you're stupid, you suck, LOL, Lyle. And I'm like, but there's like 3 or 4 years ago, I think the winner of the World's Strongest Man came out and said, the average person has no business deadlifting. Because the risk to reward.
That was Oberst, exactly. Robert Oberst.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, on Joe Rogan. Yeah.
Right, it's easy for me, for my dumb ass, to come out and say it. But this guy's a strong, and he's like, yes, the average person has no business doing a conventional deadlift. Because the risk to reward is so poor or so high. The benefits, now, trap bar deadlift, that's a very different animal. Right, that's a completely different thing. That is a desperately underrated movement
I don't know if I would agree. I think arguing it's a net cost is a step too far. Like, if you take an average sedentary person and teach them how to deadlift properly, you know, with instructions, so that they're not rounding at the low back, I think it would probably do more good than harm, just to strengthen their low back. Like, if you got some person with back pain, you know.
Okay, two things. One, there are better ways to strengthen the low back. And this is going to sound really condescending, and it kind of is, but it's not meant to be. You say that as someone who has never coached someone in the weight room.
That's not true, but...
Well, anyway. But unless you're coaching someone hands-on day after day after day, they will F up the deadlift. They will F up the squat. They will.
Yeah.
And you can go into any... This is something where people really do forget. The way I coach someone in person is completely different than what I do if I'm writing a program up. I can do things, if I'm watching them every day, Rit forgets this. It's one thing for him to be teaching these movements under the watchful eye of an instructor every single day. You can get away with stuff. If I have 3 sessions with someone, which is common when you're a general personal trainer, You ain't teaching someone a proper deadlift in that amount of time that can be done safely, period. You can tell me I'm wrong, but I'm not, because I've tried. It cannot be done. And that's the problem. Even if you cannot get them to even basic technical competency on that complicated of a movement and have them be able to do it safely and progressively ever. Whereas I can teach someone something simpler in 10 minutes. And there are better ways to strengthen the low back. Because I've seen that argument. Oh, yeah, when I had someone training me every day and taught me a conventional deadlift. My low back feels better. Yeah, great. Because you had a hands-on trainer every day. That's the problem. And I did an entire video about this on my channel. There's a difference, which I will never update again, just so people realize. And I talked about it was coached versus uncoached training, because you can do totally different things.
Yeah, that was a good video.
The stuff that I got away with Sumi, I could never do writing up a program for someone.
Yeah.
Because I can't be there. I can't see it. I cannot give them the heuristics that I would use on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, I would agree with you. If you can coach them every day in the gym.
Or even just to the point where they can do it properly. Solid.
But how many sessions is that going to take? The average person doesn't have it.
I guess, you know, for the listeners of our podcast, there would be numerous folks willing to put in that kind of effort, but we tend to attract a more serious audience.
This is not, yeah, look, I spent a decade studying every aspect because I wanted to know from my own lifting, even before I got into this in any sort of professional way, because that was my obsession. We're talking about Gen Pop, dude. Everyone likes to whine about, oh, Planet Fitness doesn't let people squat and deadlift. I'm like, have you ever watched the average person squat and deadlift in a commercial gym? It's an absolute tragedy. So yes, as a global statement, maybe he's not correct. But in the aggregate, for the general population who can barely focus on a machine bicep curl because they're too busy on their phone, they have no business deadlifting. They have no business back squatting. They have no business doing any of those movements. Honestly, considering that they spend 90% of their training time on their phone, they should just go for a nice walk, because they're not accomplishing anything in the weight room except annoying me by sitting on equipment that I want to use for 10 minutes while they look at their phone during the set. They do not, general population.
You are spot on. If I go into a commercial gym, the average person performing a barbell movement has no clue.
And no business doing it.
Yeah.
It was really funny. This is someone I coached many, many years ago, and their technique on everything except the RDL was atrocious, because they were modeling, they'd learned the RDL watching someone online doing it properly, and they'd learned every other movement by watching people at their gym do it. It's better now. Back in the day, if I was in a commercial gym and saw someone squatting well, it was such a rare occurrence. I would always go ask them. I go, you used to Olympic, 99 times out of 100, they were Olympic lifters. You can tell. I can tell an Olympic lifter like that.
It's actually really funny. I've squatted in commercial gyms in the past and been asked the same question.
Sure.
You an Olympic lifter?
You're an exception. Right? Now it's a little bit better, because as much as social media has made things worse, at least there is good people. I have noticed that people, I'm seeing proportionally, by which I mean 2 out of every 10 instead of 1 out of every 50 squat that might actually be decent. Maybe. But it's still not the norm. Usually you see the same craptastic half squat, knees in, up on the toes, BS that I've seen for 30 years. Most people have no business doing these movements. And the deadlift is even potentially worse, because if you do something wrong on the deadlift, which is very, very easy, things go bad. At least the bar doesn't fall on you. But if you get a low back injury, you're done.
Yeah, absolutely. And that holds even for trained lifters, because the temptation to add weight to the bar, even if you know how to perform the deadlift properly, can lead you to perform it improperly by chasing PRs, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Which is also potentially true, I suppose. But again, something goes awry on a machine chest press. It doesn't go
that. Yeah, nothing's happening.
Right? Nothing.
So I, like, I, yeah. I think most more than of those other types lifts.
Yes.
There's like a Goldilocks zone with the deadlift and the squat where, you know, you need to be careful in a way that you don't on other exercises.
Correct.
Careful chasing PRs. If you just go completely gung-ho, everything to failure on a machine chest press.
Nothing bad really happens.
Yeah, whereas on a squat or a deadlift, that could, you know, destroy you potentially.
Like I said, that could be a career ender. It absolutely can. And again, that's one of these things, like, again, while there's certain training approaches, it is one thing to be coached, right? Again, I have no love for starting strength. I don't like the way they teach a lot of things, but that chasing 5 pounds a week, it's one thing when you're being overseen and someone is telling you when you read in a book, add 5 pounds a week every week, it always goes wrong, especially when they don't realize that, okay, fine, if you're writing that for a high school dude, that's a very different pot. Because you see, they're like, oh yeah, I was 45 and I got into starting strength and I thought I could add 5 pounds a week. That's what it said. And like, yeah, and you're a 45-year-old untrained woman. But people forget that. What I would write or recommend to someone in a consult would be very different than if I'm coaching them hands-on or coaching them occasionally. Because like, talked about that video and I'm like, okay, I coach Suni 6 days a week. I was in the gym with her every day.
Yeah.
I could make micro adjustments. I was seeing what was going on every day, every set, every rep. When her daughter started powerlifting, she and I sort of dual coaching. So Sumi would do the two during the week workouts, and I would write those up based on the Saturday workout, which I would oversee. And during the week, I had to keep it a little bit more conservative because like I wasn't there. I couldn't see how the bar was moving. On Saturday, when I was there, I could do things very differently. Right? I'm like, all right, today's a PR. I can see it. I can feel it. And it would. But on the other, and then when I was coaching Michelle, which was by distance by video, right, I would get videos from her every week. And I could see, all right, I could see her bar speed. And I could see, you know, and she didn't, because of her age and her, you know, she wasn't dealing with potential weekly fluctuations in strength, you know, high school things that Sumi's daughter, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, like, I can look at the video and go, okay, I can tell by the bar speed change, but I would still have to write up, like, the workouts much more, and I couldn't adjust them, right? With Sumi, if we're in the day, I'm like, oh, yeah, you look like, you know, you look like trash today. I would adjust the workout, and I'm like, you look strong. I don't care what my progression is. I'm not going to waste the day. If you're ready to hit a big number, we're taking it, we're taking it weekend. But if I'm writing up and if I'm consulting someone, I can't even do that. I have to give them my best approximation of a rule set of when this happens and this, you notice this on this set of an exercise in terms of how it's moving, that's when you go up. And it might be a week and it might be a month and it won't happen till it happens. But a lot of times when people write up their training programs, they're just like, oh, you're going to add 5% a week every week and then drop back and do this. And it's like, yeah, and it works until it doesn't. And it's the same thing with teaching technique. What I can, like I said, when I was a personal trainer at a commercial gym, I usually had 3 sessions with someone. I had to get someone from zero to competent in 3 30-minute sessions. Sorry, I'm not teaching a barbell bench press. I'm teaching maybe a dumbbell bench press or a machine chest press, but I'm not teaching anything more complex than that. Especially if it's gym pop that is not going to have the focused interest or attention to do them. Even if I could have gotten them to full competency in 3 sessions, that wasn't, and again, yes, it's goal specific. It depends on the person. I get that. But what he was saying was that for the average trainee looking for general musculoskeletal strength and fitness, the deadlift is not a good choice. Because a trap bar is a much better movement, even if Rick thinks it's a shitty exercise, but we're not getting into that. That's a whole
sagittal plane.
That's just barbell myopia. Whatever. So I think that sort of summarizes my thoughts about the big bar.
Yeah, I guess just one final thing I wanted to ask about, kind of central to your critique of some of these big barbell exercises, was that for any exercise to be like stimulative of growth in a muscle, it has to reach a certain proximity to failure.
The muscle has to reach a certain proximity to failure.
Yeah, the muscle has to reach a certain, which I don't disagree with. I don't disagree with that at all. Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant to say. Thanks for clarifying. Do you think that argument kind of weakens the case that, you know, the prevailing notion in the fitness industry that we should count for, this actually, I think, came from you, that we should count.
I know where this is going. Yeah,
you know where it's going. Like, okay, that we should count a set of like rows or pull-ups as half a set for the biceps.
Yeah, okay. Yes, I know. I remember you emailed me about this a while back, and I'm like, damn it, I need to interview with somebody who doesn't think as critically as you. But I got an answer. I've been thinking about it.
Cool.
Here's the difference. It is highly likely for a smaller muscle to fail before a bigger muscle. If you do a set of bench press, let's say you do a set of chest press to 2 reps in reserve, odds are it's still triceps that are failing, right? You're still usually get stuck. It's the lockout. You might fail off the chest. A smaller muscle will always be closer in proximity to failure than a bigger muscle, but that may not hold in the reverse section. If you take a chest press to 2 reps in reserve, triceps should be at 2 reps in reserve or closer to failure. It won't necessarily work in the opposite direction. If your triceps fail long before your chest, you've gotten an effective set for triceps and may not have gotten an effective set for the chest. That's why. And that's my story, and I'm sticking with it because that's the best. But no, I can't see a case that, well, somebody will come at me and be like, nope, I've got 22-inch biceps and no mid back. And my biceps, all like, there's always one dude in the comments who's like, nope, I'm an exception, ergo you're wrong, long. Okay, look, that without fail, every article I've ever written for 30 years, there's always one guy, well, this isn't me, therefore it cannot be true. You know what the word generality means, right? You know what the word on average means? For God's sake, stop. There will always be some weird ass exception to this. Someone with truly bizarre strength balance for some weird ass reason that could possibly have a situation that during a row that their biceps would hit, that their back would somehow hit 0 reps in reserve, but their biceps would still be so much stronger that they would not. But I can't imagine it. I cannot imagine that situation where that would ever occur, right? And you can sort of prove this to yourself, right? So do you know what a shrug back is?
Yeah.
Okay, so shrug back is just a row without the arm pull, right?
Yep.
Shrug back, row. That's it. Pretty much anybody, if you take a set of rows to say, to 0 reps in reserve, it will almost always be biceps that fail. You will fail in the middle. But odds are you'll be able to do 1 or 2 more reps. Or, now start with shrug backs. Do a set of shrug back and then go immediately into rows. You'll be able to keep going, right? So I just don't see anytime a large muscle during a compound exercise gets 2 reps in reserve, a smaller muscle will always be at that or closer. Whereas I don't think it'll work in the opposite direction. If you're squatting and your low back gives out, your quads may be nowhere close. But then again, I don't count low back volume out of squats. Now, do I? Usually, most of the volume overlap comes in upper body, the way I program stuff. You don't see nearly as much overlap in lower body, right? When you're squatting, yeah, you get some glutes, depending on how deep you go, depending on what you're doing. Hamstrings, not so much. If you look at my workouts, quad and hamstring volumes are pretty equal. But if you look at the upper body workouts, they almost always have a reduced bicep tricep volume. But that depends on if you're doing compound pushing and pulling.
If you're not, then you raise the isolation work.
Sure. Which is all going back to my argument that you could do pure isolations and get, that would be the issue, right? Let's say if you did 8 sets of compound chest, I would count that as 4 sets of triceps.
Mm.
Fractional sets is the one big meta, the meta-analysis by those two guys. I just want to say smugly, you go back and look at my volume articles from back in the day, and I was like, we should count the smaller muscle groups as 1/2 because that's rational. when they wrote their big papers, they're like, yeah, we thought we should look at it in terms of fractional sets. And we assume that a compound exercise should be counted as one half on a smaller muscle group. I'm like, huh, wow, that sounds really familiar. Gee, what an idea. Indeed. So even they sort of like it, but it only works, I think, in the one, it only works from larger and smaller, not in the lower section. So yeah, so like, let's say if you did 8 sets of compound pushing, I would only program like 3 or 4 sets for triceps to get the same 8 total. You get 4 fractional sets and then four more direct sets.
Yeah. Whereas
let's say you did 8 sets of pec deck, you got to do 8 sets of triceps.
Yeah. And I like how earlier you flagged that compound isolation is a spectrum.
Sure.
You know, because like a really wide grip bench, for instance, might have your pecs failing long before your triceps do.
Oh, absolutely.
Medium grip might have your triceps and pecs failing more about evenly. And then a close grip, your triceps fail first.
Make no mistake. Like when I threw at that one half, I made it very clear. I'm like, look, I'm not saying it's exactly one half, but we know it's not one. We know it's not zero. We know it's not 1-to-1. Right. Mm. So let's just, I got to pick some, because I know people, I'm sure, like I had paragraphs and I'm like, let's not be pedantic nitpickers. Right. It's probably not 0.9, probably not 0.1. Maybe it's 0.6. Maybe it depends on the exercise. Right. Like for a cable row, an undergrip cable row is way more biceps than a V-grip cable row, which is really more brachialis if you want to get really anal retentive about it, right? Like we could get, but when I was writing that article series, like I'm not trying to write a tome on how I might apply this in the real world. I'm just saying that when we are looking at these volume studies, you can't do compound chest and then measure triceps and go, that's the optimal volume for triceps. That doesn't make any sense. And again, the big metas that came later will just agree completely with what I said, even if Brad's dumb set counting paper didn't, because he was trying to say I was wrong. I think good coaches do this in practice. Again, this is one of those things that when I'm writing, as it was in those articles, or if I was going to write something, you know, like when I write up that workout, I can't sit there and write, well, I would do this if this and this if this. And if I used a V-bar, then I would have to worry more about biceps femur, biceps brachii, short head, because blah, 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 blah. I'm just like, we're not getting into that. I might do that in a coaching context. I'll do that in consultation because I have to take into account that. But when I'm writing it, we got to go with slightly simpler heuristics, right? And I would just say that, yeah, if you've done this type, okay, fine. You need 4 direct sets for biceps. Do 2 of a barbell curl and 2 hammer curls to get your brachialis if you really care. Like there is overlap in a coaching context. You're going to be able to take, and I'm sure good coaches that when they look at those things are absolutely taking that into context, right? So if I had someone doing a row here, the biceps are not super involved and the lats are not super involved. It's we've taken the lats out of the movement by removing shoulder extension. There is not, you're getting some elbow flexion, but you're not getting full elbow flexion, right? Like an undergrip, pull down, you're going full excursion of the biceps. A medium grip, is there some arm flexion? Yeah, but not nearly as much. So for example, if I was training someone and I had them doing mostly either an undergrip or a V-bar pull down, I would probably give them less direct bicep work. If I had them doing a medium overhand grip, I would probably give them a little bit more based on just an internal heuristic experience. This is not as much bicep involvement or as much training as this is, or this is, or this is. Same reason that if I use a close grip row, like a V-bar row or an undergrip row that involves a lot of lats, and actually going back to the, if you had to pick one exercise, if I had to pick one back exercise, it would be either an undergrip or a V-bar row. You will get biceps, lats in shoulder extension, and scapular retraction. That one exercise will do it all. If you want to take lats out, for example, as I'm programming for someone that has dominant lats and needs to bring up their mid-back.
Is that even possible?
All the, sure. You get the elbows
shaped
out.
Like a Dorito? What's the story?
They've got a giant lat, but their mid-back development is just not as good.
Got it.
So I need to pick an exercise specifically that trains the mid-back without the lats, because otherwise the lats are going to take over that movement.
Because
the body will always find the most efficient way. So every one of their rows is going to be elbows flared, or even a reverse pec deck with scapular retraction. Now I'm deliberately taking the lats out. So that would affect back volumes. Most people, I know back is complicated, and they're like, well, there's mid-back, and there's lats, and there's traps one, which is really kind of separate, and there's low back, which I consider core. When I think of back, I think of traps 2, 3, 4, depending on who you talk to. And then I just, mid-back, teres, rhomboids, don't care, and then lats. But if you pick the right exercises, you do not need that many to work everything. Like I said, an undergrip cable row or undergrip row will work the entire traps 2, 3, 4, scapular retractors, and lats. That one movement. If you add a lat movement, direct lat movement of any sort, like you're sorted. And you know, my Facebook group, go find the pictures of Sumi's back. She did two exercises her entire career. V-bar cable row twice a week, V-bar pull down once a week. And her other volume didn't count. Like, yeah, she was doing trap bar deadlift for 3x3 and rack pull and shit. But it was just like, nope. Again, yes, I realize there's a drug issue, but if you look at like Dorian's exercise selection, super logical. Go look at his back workout. He had, you know, an undergrip rowing movement, the eighth row, which he did switch to overhand. He had a pullover, pure lats. He had a one-arm row. Like, he didn't do 18 exercises for back. He did 4 of the right exercises. Because there's so much overlap if you pick your exercises correctly. Debate I had once with my training partner years ago is like, why do people like so many chest exercises? Like, and why do they always got to finish like 5 sets of pec deck? He's like, I think it's because they don't feel their chest during their flat bench. And I think he's absolutely right. I consulted with someone else and I'm like, why are you doing all this extra work for chest and not for other muscle groups? He goes, well, I don't really feel my pecs when I bench. So I do cable crossover at the end to get a pump. And I go, well, let me teach you how to bench with your pecs and you won't need that. Waiting to hear back. But it always works. Every time I talk to you, and I give these people that I'm like, no. I'm like, look, barbell bench press first is not like start with pec deck or crossover or dumbbell fly, free exhaust your pecs, then do 2 sets of that heavy, and then go to 2 sets of barbell bench. And they're like, wow, this is the first time that I actually really felt my pecs get a stimulus and be involved in both movements. Because now, in that case, again, for people with lanky arms or lanky legs, start with isolations. And there have been bodybuilders over the years that recommended that. Start the isolation stuff. Hire the muscle out first. Then you don't have to go as heavy on the big stuff. And you still get a better stimulus. Because now these other muscles can help you better, can help you further train. Right? Like, okay, so the lateral raise upright row combo. I would probably ideally have someone do lateral raise first to get the, because I know if I take, if they do a proper lateral raise 2 reps in reserve, I know what hits 2 reps in reserve. Is their medial delts, period. There's no debate. Then I would have to do upright row next. And the guy would be, why? What does it do? Well, it lets the biceps now assist in further wrecking the medial delts, to put it in physiological terms. Like, yeah, you could just do upright. You just could do lateral raises set after set, and that would work too. But people get bored. So I'm like, do two sets, or they pace themselves. Some people, when they're like, oh, I got 4 sets, somehow 4 sets of 8 is different psychologically than 2 sets of 8 of 2 exercises. 4 sets of 8, they pace themselves. Like, I got 3 more sets of upright rows. They've only got 2 sets of upright rows, they'll go a lot harder. And the 2 sets of, all right, 4 sets of lateral raises will parse differently than 2 and 2. And they'll go harder if they do 2 and 2.
Maybe that's why, like, the 2 sets of a bunch of different exercises is like the prevailing approach among UK bodybuilders,
yeah, like you see it kind of go through. And someone, this was again a couple of years ago, and I wrote this super ranty piece in my Facebook group, because a lot of people get really hung up on what I consider minor details rather than fundamental principles. And they've read some article, I want to say it was by C-Dub, who's like, for back, he preferred to do 2 sets of 4 different exercises than 4 sets of 2 exercises. And this guy's like, I don't. I'm like, look, four sets of two exercises is eight sets. Two sets of four set exercises is eight sets. Who cares? Pick the one that fits you, the equipment you have, what you like to do. He's also an elite pro-level bodybuilder who probably does need to have a little more attention to minor details. He has to worry about, you know, the rhomboid minor lat tie-in. You need a bigger back. So it doesn't, like, big picture stuff. It all achieves the same damn thing, right? So if you want to do, Dan Duchesne, actually, a really interesting idea that I think is unique. I think the basis of it was flawed, but I think it was an interesting idea. And his point was, realize this was 2000, this was like Poliquin was a big thing. And he's like, look, most of these people in the field are strength coaches. He's like, strength is hugely neurological, which is true. And he's like, their goal is to improve, you know, strength is skill and strength, like neurologically. And he goes, but that's not, maybe we need size coaches, right? Now his mistake, well, he's not wrong, right? They are similar but different in terms of what you're attempting to do, right? Strength is very specific, as I just had to explain to someone earlier today. Hypertrophy is totally local, totally general, right? It's just whatever. It's just local to the muscle. Strength, super neurological, super specific. What he says, so like if you're doing four sets of one exercise, this is where Dan got it wrong. He said, you know, you're getting those neurological improvements set to set. Okay, now that doesn't happen in advanced individuals. That's where he was incorrect in the physiology. But his concern was like, the reason that you're getting a stimulus is because your body's getting more neurologically efficient across sets. He goes, maybe it'd be better to do one set of eight exercises so that there is no neurological practice component. And I don't, like I said, I think he reached an interesting conclusion from an incorrect premise in that, I mean, and that's just like the logical extension of what we just talked about. Okay, you could do eight sets of eight of an exercise. You're really good at it, right? And there have been guys that did that, that were just perfectly built and they're like, yeah, all I do is 20 sets of chest and my chest and shoulders and triceps get huge because they have perfectly balanced physiques, perfectly balanced musculature, that's it. Then there's guys who are like, yeah, you know, then you get to the Arnold guy, like, yeah, we did four or five sets of four exercises. Got to hit all the angles. Let's bring it to non-ridiculous volumes, right? Say you're doing eight sets of eight. Two reps in reserve. Okay. For your back. You can do eight sets of eight under grip pull down. Or sorry, under grip row. That would get everything. You might get bored crapless, and you might pace yourself. All right, so let's divide it up a little bit. All right, let's do four sets of an undergrip row, and then we'll do four sets of a lat movement. All right, cool. Maybe let's go C-dub style. Let's do two sets of an undergrip row, two sets of an elbows high row to take the lats out of it, two sets of a V-bar pull down to get lats in extension, and two sets of a medium overgrip to get lats in abduction. All right. Well, Dan would just go, well, let's just do one set. We'll do one set of undergrip, one set of elbows high, one set of this pull down, one set of pullovers, one set of this, one set of shrug backs. Big picture, would it make a difference? Only in that I could never think of that many useful exercises for a given muscle group. Like, honestly, if you want to know why I think I tend to take a simplistic approach to exercise selection, I can never think of enough exercises that are worth a damn. There's so much redundancy. There's so much overlap. You're just doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. But
yeah, I got a friend who really adopted that Dan Duchesne approach. Mm-hmm. And he does like his chest workouts the following way. He does a flat press, then a 15 degree incline, then a 30 mm-hmm. degree incline, then a 45 degree incline, and then a 60 degree. And then he does all these different crossover heights. Yep. You know, that's his chest workout.
I mean, again, same thing. Like, usually the problem with that is people are like, they do five sets of each redundant exercise, right? This is like, I've pointed this out repeatedly. Like, here's the typical, you know, gym rat chest workout.
Yeah.
Three sets of flat bench, three sets of dumbbell bench, three sets of chest press. Okay, those are all the same movement. Oh, and of course, three sets of cable crossover. Because they need
followed by push-ups.
Then
Maybe.
Incline barbell bench, dumbbell incline bench, incline Smith machine. I'm like, those are all the same movement. At least if you're going to do multiple exercises per muscle group, do them with different, that they're different.
Right? Yeah.
And that could be a number of ways. Like biceps is even worse. Holy crap. The biceps bend the elbow. Fine. There's a little bit of supination. There's a little bit of shoulder flexion. How many effing exercises do you need for a muscle that does that one thing? And the answer is not many. If you're going to do it, at least pick exercises rationally. So what I tell
people... I've actually uploaded a video in which you go through basically exactly this, like all the exercises you do for each body part.
Yeah, it just in a general sense, like, cause what do you see? Barbell curl, dumbbell curl, cable curl, it's all the same movement.
Mm.
At least do a different. So when I consult with people, or if I ever got around to writing something about training, like at least look at it biomechanically. The biceps, you can sort of define three different positions of the elbow relative to the torso. Elbows by the side, elbows in front, elbows behind the body. If you're going to do multiple exercises, at least make them different in terms of their length tension relationship, the position. Same thing for triceps. There's only two. Elbows up from the torso, whether it's a nose breaker, a skull crusher, whatever, or it's an overhead French press to get tricep long head. Elbows by the side. That's it. That's what triceps do. The end. That's it. Lats do two things. They extend at the shoulder. They 80 duck. That's it. That's all you need. And you don't even really need both of those if you're doing it right. Right? And I know I'm sure the same video, one thing that I brought up repeatedly, probably the most coherent approach to exercise selection that I've ever seen. Positions of Flexion by Steve Holman from Iron Man Magazine. Which is interesting because based on the current fads that have now gone away, he believed that the optimal hypertrophy in terms of the best way to train a muscle was you should pick an exercise that trained the muscle. One exercise should have peak force at the mid-range. That's usually your compound. Should have then another that had peak force in the stretch position. And then a third that had the greatest resistance in the peak contraction position.
Mm.
Right? So chest, that would be a barbell or dumbbell bench, something compound. Really, a pec deck, like a fly, would probably be stretched.
Maybe like a dumbbell fly, right?
Yeah, so that it's predominantly in the stretch position, and then a crossover is peak contraction. Quads would be a compound quad movement.
Yep.
Leg extensions are peak contraction.
Maybe like a CC squat.
CC squat. Stretch position.
Yeah.
That's at least coherent, because you're at least, and his was very, he did like two sets, like six sets a piece per muscle group. Two of each. It's probably of all, at least it made sense. At least there was a logic to it of picking exercises that were doing different, at least subtly different things biomechanically. But that's not how most people approach it. And yeah, there was, I've crapped out a couple lists. I'm like, look, if you had to pick one exercise per muscle group, I would do this. If you were going to do two, I would do this and I would add a second one. And honestly, the majority of muscle groups, you can get it done in two if you pick the right exercise. Back, maybe three. But by and large, there's just too many. People do too many redundant exercises that are all doing the same thing. But again, it's a volume thing, right? Your buddy, most people would approach that chest workout as four sets of each of those eight exercises. At least he's only doing one a piece.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Like, okay, is it what I would do? No, because I'm lazy and I don't feel like adjusting stuff or keeping track of that many different ways. But do I have a fundamental problem with it? No. Genuinely, similar thing. I had a buddy of mine.
I mean, the problem would be missing the forest for the trees. Like if that same person, my friend, were, you know, not to eat very well or not to apply progressive overload or train particularly hard, then there would be a problem.
No, but like I think... I know you're not trying to make a straw man argument, but I tend to just assume, like, I know it's dumb to assume those other things are self-evident, but when we're discussing this, I'm assuming that those other things are in play. right
yeah,
now.
No, I just like, wanted to express kind of my personal distaste for fiddling around with things which I see as relatively minor contributors to someone's ultimate success in the weight room or the bodybuilding stage.
Sure, but again, big picture stuff. 8 sets of 1 exercise, 4 sets of 2 exercises, 2 sets of 4 exercises, 1 set of 8 different exercises. Big picture stuff, who gives a crap? Like, that would be more about what fits the person's psychology, their interest. Like, consider that for him mentally, I'm not saying this is or isn't the case, but consider that for him, thinking in terms of, I've only got 1 set of this exercise, he might train harder. Because if someone knows, this is just interesting. Someone asked Arnold one time in the gym, how many sets do you have left? And he said, just this 1. And he wasn't being facetious, and he didn't mean he only had 1 more set before the workout was over. What he was saying was, nothing exists to me except what I am doing at this moment. I'm not thinking about what I've done, but I'm not thinking about what I have left to do. It was an indicator of his level of focus and intensity. All that mattered was that singular set. And once it was done, then he's got the next set. Perhaps for the person you're talking about, by thinking in terms of, I've only got 1 set of this exercise, I don't have to pace myself. I don't have to worry about how much do I need to adjust the weight on the second set due to fatigue. Maybe he's training harder than he ever was. I'm not saying he is or he isn't, but for people with a certain psychology, that is a possibility. And for others, it's not. Like I said, me, I'm super lazy. If I can do 3 exercises, like I train purely dog crap rest pause style now. I do not like being in the gym. I'm old. I'm tired. I just want to get in and get it done. And I'm good at intensity. Like, yeah, when I was dieting, I did 1 exercise per muscle group, maintenance. Now that I'm back to upper lower, I'll do 2, maybe 3 if I'm feeling particularly saucy. I'll do 1 rest pause set of like 2 or 3 different exercises and go home. But I give it, you know, and again, you look at Dorian, he did 1 all-out top set of carefully selected exercises that hit everything he needed to hit. And it was I look at it and go, yeah, that's pretty much what I came up with. You know, his triceps workout, he did a decline, he did a nose breaker, he did a 2-arm pushdown, and then he believed in finishing with a 1-arm exercise for better, you know, mental focus, central drive. He felt that he got a better stimulus. So that he did 3 sets for triceps. And he did 1 with the elbows up from the body, 2 with the elbows down by the body. Yeah. Rear delts, he did reverse pec deck and bent over dumbbell row or bent over dumbbell lateral. Because what the hell else do the rear delts do? How many freaking exercises do you need for the rear delts? What do the medial delts do? That's it. I realize there was a study in the 2000s that said the delts had 7 different segments that everybody went nuts over. Because if you take Garanda, who said that a muscle has 4 sides, upper, lower, inner, outer, that means that the delts need 28 exercises, 4 for every segment. Or you can just let pressing take care of front delts, do some rear delt work, and then do a little bit of direct medial delt work. It's a tiny muscle. How much work do you need? And yet people do 4 exercises for each of the head of the delt, right? There's no logic to it. None.
Yeah, so there you go. Thank you. Yeah, no. There everyone goes.
And I think it's interesting. I don't keep up with, you know, the trends among natural or drug using bodybuilders, but it wouldn't surprise, you know, usually it's whoever's successful people copy. So I'm sure people looked at C-Dub and they're like, oh, he does 2 sets of 4 exercises.
C-Bum? Like Chris Bumstead?
Whatever. C-Dub. No, I do actually do. I C-Bum. Chris Bumstead. Although, you know, they're like, okay, well, he does 2 sets for 4 exercises. There are worse ways to train. That's for damn sure. At the very, you know, that's at least rational to me. The problem is, again, when people do that, usually they're multiple exercise routines. They're doing 4 or 5 sets of each exercise, and it's overkill completely.